Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also moving up the dial to 101.1 FM, where we will be simulcasting for the next few months until we find our permanent home at 101.1 FM. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we will be speaking to Julia Dolan, who is with the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and she will be talking about Lewis Hines' Empire State Building photographs in the popular press. That's later on today. Right now, I would like to welcome Michael Yates. He is the author of the book Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist's Travelogue, and he will be at Garcia Street Books at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's a wonderful book and a very interesting start. I mean, this is your story. At the age of 55, you and your wife sold just about everything or got rid of most of your possessions, went on the road. You were a professor of economics. Decided to retire early. What motivated you to make such a dramatic change?
Well, the truth of it was is that I was tired of teaching. I didn't like the way that the universities were changing, becoming more and more businesslike, and the way they operated, more concerned with the bottom line than with educating students. And I also wasn't very happy with the change in the student body, with students thinking more about education as a consumer good rather than as a way to learn things. And as I became a little bit more alienated and unhappy with my job, I decided that if I could, I would quit. And when I turned 55, I was lucky because my pension grew large enough so that if we lived frugally, we could start withdrawing money from it and live without me teaching anymore. So we decided in 2001 that I would retire. We gave away nearly everything we owned, packed the rest up in our van, and took off to see the country. And we've been seeing it for 6 years now.
So, did you decide at the beginning that you were going to write a travelogue, or is that something that developed over time as you traveled?
No, we decided to embark upon a new way of living, to make our life be one of exploring the country and seeing what we could see and observing things. When we were living in Portland, Oregon in 2004, we decided to ditch pretty much whatever other property we had and make an open-ended road trip without any particular destination in mind. And it was during that trip and afterwards, when we were living in Miami Beach, that I got the idea for this book. I got the idea that it would be interesting to write a travelogue, which would make people excited to visit places or to think about places that they'd already been, and at the same time make commentary based upon my knowledge as an economist and the things that we'd observed. I don't know of any other economist travelogue. This might be the first one. I'm not sure about that, but that's when we got the idea. I didn't embark upon this to write a book. The book came afterwards.
It's very interesting as a travelogue. There's almost a little bit of guidebook in it too, because when there's a places that you like, you mention them and give the address and phone number. But for example, for Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you give the population, the racial breakdown, the median household income, the rent, the median mortgage, the percentage of people below the poverty level. Sometimes you give the altitude. Sometimes you talk about the employment in the city. That's very interesting information that most people don't get when they walk into a town.
Well, I thought that would be interesting to have a little capsule sketch of certain places in each chapter. Not every place that we visited, but the ones that struck me the most, or places that we'd lived. And yes, I did think that was that would be interesting information. Most people wouldn't know what average income was, or what percentage of people were below the poverty level, or what the average rent was. And then I tried to throw in some sort of cute thing, like Pittsburgh is the most misspelled city in the country, or that Johnstown, Pennsylvania has the steepest inclined plane in the country, or something like that. You know, just to add a little bit of humor to those little sketches at the beginning.
And do those kinds of statistics and, above all, your training as an economist really affect the way that you saw the town and moved within it?
Yes, I think they did. At least they began to. For instance, when I lived in Manhattan, I walked to work every day. It was about a mile and a half walk, and you just couldn't help but notice for example, I used to walk by the ABC store, which is a real famous store, Jerry Seinfeld's favorite store in New York. It's a big furniture store. Stuff's very expensive there, and across the street there'd always be the same homeless guy sleeping in a corner. Or I was on West 27th Street, which was where the office was, where I worked, and every day it's in the garment district, and every day there'd be just people working so hard early in the morning, and then when I'd get off work in the winter and it'd be dark when I got off work, the same people would still be there loading and unloading trucks, and you just couldn't help but notice the kind of work people were doing, the color of the skin of the people that did the work. You'd go to the farmer's market in Union Square, and you'd see the chefs getting their field greens for the fancy restaurants. At the same time, in Union Square Park, you'd see a guy surreptitiously selling batteries and all kinds of trinkets. And those are the kind of things I noticed, because I'm an economist. I'm trained to look for that kind of thing. I was looking for the kind of work people did, the disparities between rich and poor, and that kind of thing. And those are the things that caught my eye that might not have caught an ordinary tourist's eye.
We're talking to Michael Yates, author of the book Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate. One thing that you noticed was that the majority of really hard work was done by non-white people.
Well, that's certainly true. I noticed that for sure in the West. And you noticed that. I noticed that in New York City and in Miami Beach as well. If you're in Miami Beach, for example, and you get in a cab, chances are a Haitian will be the cab driver. Those are the kind of things that you notice right away. If you go into the grocery stores, everybody will be Hispanic. They may or may not be Cuban Americans in Miami Beach. Probably these days, a lot of the poorer jobs are not done by Cuban Americans. Some of them would be. In the West, we stayed in a lot of cheap motels, because when we're on the road, we stay in cheap motels and cook our food on that hot plate. Hence the title of the book. But it would be very, very rare that you would see a white person cleaning a motel room in the West. They would almost always be Hispanic. They would almost always have their children at work with them. Those are the kind of things that I observed and noticed. The poorer the work, the more likely it would be that a person of color did the work.
The title Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate is not just about your experience, but it's about the experience of a lot of working poor people who are trying to survive.
Yeah, well, the second night out after we left Portland, when we hit the road and stayed in the cheap motels, was in Redding, California. And I noticed that there was laundry hanging over the railing on the second floor. And it wasn't like laundry that a person in a motel would do, because if the motel has a washer, they'd have a dryer and people would be drying it. This was their sheets and bedding that they were hanging out over the railing, and you just knew right away that there was somebody living in that motel. And all across the country, we noticed that in cheap motels, if you see bicycles or you see old trucks or you see children playing, then you know that people are living in those motels. And a hot plate might actually be a luxury. We learned from this one show, we heard it on the radio or read it in the newspaper, but the most common cooking implement for people that don't have kitchen facilities is a George Foreman grill. So a hot plate might be a luxury for some people. So people live in motels out of necessity, because you don't need the first and last month's rent. You don't need a credit check. It's not a good deal economically to live in a motel, but that people are forced to do that by their circumstances.
Well, as has been pointed out in so many corners, including in the loan and credit card industry and in groceries and housing, it's expensive to be poor.
No, it certainly is. And we were in Bozeman, Montana one time, and I saw a big sign that said title pawn. This was a number of years ago, and I didn't know what a title pawn was. Well, a title pawn is where you pawn your car, basically. You get to drive it, but somebody else has the title. You pawn the title, in effect. Now title pawn shops are everywhere. You can always tell a poor neighborhood or a neighborhood that's becoming poor by all the quick loan shops, by all the furniture rental places. And, of course, they charge very high rates of interest, sometimes 1,000% a year or more. Or you see...
So if you can't pay loan shark rates, you lose your car.
Right, exactly. Or you see buy here, pay here car places, where poor people can buy cars without credit checks and that kind of thing. Of course, the cars are expensive. You can also build tires into the car. If you have to have a car inspected, for example, and they need good tires and you don't have them, you can go back to that buy here, pay here place, and you can essentially borrow tires. You can build the tires into the payment for the car, or repairs into the payment for the car. And then when you trade the car in, of course, you got to go to the same kind of place, because they'll give you the best price for the car. So you get stuck in a trap of debt that a lot of poor people are in.
The economic travelogue that you wrote is a little bit about your own economics as well. You retired as a professor. The first thing you did was you and your wife both had jobs working at Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah.
You were a desk clerk. She worked in a restaurant there. What was your work situation there like?
Well, it was. I always put it this way: it's a good learning experience. When you're a college professor, being a college professor, certainly in job I had as a tenured professor of economics, that's a pretty privileged job in the United States. You have a lot of control over your time and your work, and the pay's pretty good, and you get automatic respect. And then I went from that to being a desk clerk, where I wore a uniform and I had a sign that said Michael from Pennsylvania on it. So when somebody came into the desk and they saw a gray-haired man with a uniform on and a sign, they might feel pity, but they wouldn't feel automatic respect. And so it was a good learning experience for me. I was tired at the end of the day. My legs were tired. My brain was tired. Computer codes kept going through my head all night. I'd run through arguments that I had with customers and that kind of thing. It was a completely different experience. And I started to imagine, really, I knew a lot about work. That's one of my fields of study. But I started to feel in my body and in my brain for the first time what it would be like to do a job like that over an extended period of time or for a lifetime, what that would mean to you, and not to have health care and to have low wages and not to be able to make ends meet. It was really quite an interesting learning experience for me. It reconfirmed a lot of things that I knew about work, but it personalized them in a way that just study can't do.
And one of the things is when you are asked to work, as you often were, without sufficient breaks for meals, without sufficient staffing to cover the needs that were coming at you all the time, the level of frustration can really break you.
No, it really can. It snowed one day in the middle of June at Yellowstone National Park, and the whole park was shut down, and people couldn't get in or get out. Well, you can imagine the desk clerk at a hotel is the front line, so to speak, for every complaint. So people just kept coming up endlessly all day long, asking, when's the snow going to stop? When can we get out of here? Why didn't you make my wake-up call? And they didn't have, they had a real antiquated phone system, and we had to do transfer calls between rooms even, and I must have got 500 phone calls on that shift. I didn't get a chance to get a break. Just people kept at you with questions and comments and hassles all day long. And one day after that, we had a similar day, and I was sick. And it really, when I was sick as a professor, I didn't go to work. I got paid anyway. You couldn't do that when you
it's
were a desk
clerk. It's called sick days, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Well, we didn't have any sick days at the hotel, so I went to work sick. And, of course, it was a miserable day of work, and you just were really irritated with the customers. And you could just imagine that if you were poor, and if you didn't have health insurance, and if you had low wages, and if you had to go to work sick, or if you had to bring your child to work as a motel clerk, how frustrating the day would be, and how angry you might get about work.
Did it change the way you treat other people? I mean, I'm sure you were always respectful because this is something that you knew about, but having personalized it, as you say.
No, I think it really did. I never did this, but I couldn't imagine being on the cell phone in a grocery store, as we often saw people at a really fancy grocery store in Miami Beach. The clerks were Hispanic, and they'd always be the model of patience, and they'd always be pleasant, and a customer would come up and be on the cell phone for the entire transaction and never look the clerk in the face. And I could never imagine myself doing that. I couldn't imagine myself being rude to a desk clerk at a hotel or to the person that cleans the room, even if they don't do it satisfactorily and I'm upset with the service. I learned a lot of humility from doing that kind of work, and a new respect for what it must mean to do that kind of work day in and day out, year in and year out.
And there's also, when reading this book, one thinks, wherever you go, in whatever job somebody is doing, you don't know who they really are.
No, you don't, and that's something that somebody asked me on a radio show the other day, what should people from higher classes understand about working people? And that's exactly what I said. I said, well, that everybody has a life, that everybody has an interesting story to tell, that everybody has complex family relationships. And also, I wanted to point out that whenever you go to a beautiful place, like, say, Santa Fe, for example, or to a national park, that there's a whole body of labor that keeps the whole thing alive. That when you go into a nice bookstore, for example, there are the clerks that work in that bookstore. When you go into a nice restaurant, in the kitchens, there are people working. When you go to that nice spa or hotel, there are people that are working and doing the jobs. When you take that horseback ride in Yellowstone National Park, there's a whole body of labor that's making that an okay experience for you. And I hope that the book will make people aware of that body of labor that keeps the whole society running.
We're talking to Michael Yates. His book is called Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist's Travelogue, and he will be at Garcia Street Book this afternoon at 5 o'clock. So you continued working. You worked at Yellowstone. You also took as much time off as you could and went hiking and enjoyed the incredible phenomena of nature there. And then you went, of all places, to Manhattan.
Well, that was interesting because Wyoming only has about 500,000 people in the whole state, and we went from there to the biggest city in the United States.
Which has 500,000 people every three blocks.
Right, exactly. So that was quite an interesting contrast. I have to say that when we moved to Manhattan, I probably was a little bit less tolerant of the noise and the pollution and the light than I would have been had I not been at Yellowstone National Park first. But we wanted to experience as much of the country as we could. I wanted to be in a place like Yellowstone, which is can be a lonely place, you know, where there's not many people in certain parts of it. Anyway, even in the height of the tourist season, you can escape and get to some place where you can be alone. In Manhattan, where you're never alone, where there were traffic jams on our street at 3 o'clock in the morning every single weekend. Now, some people said, well, why did you live in Miami Beach? You don't seem like a Miami Beach kind of person. But Miami Beach is an interesting place to live. There's such contrast between rich and poor. There's such a contrast between the beauty of the beach and the way people take care of it. I wanted to see as much of the country as I could. You can't get to know everybody, but I wanted to see as much as I could. But that was quite a contrast between Yellowstone and Manhattan, that's for sure.
What did you do when you were in Manhattan? What was your work?
Well, in Manhattan, I was an associate editor of Monthly Review magazine, which has been in continuous operation since May of 1949. And I'd worked with the magazine since the 70s. And that was an interesting kind of job, too. It was a desk job. Some parts of it I enjoyed, some parts of it I didn't. I had to take articles that weren't written very well and turn them into good articles. And that's a skill a little bit different than being a desk clerk, but it had its own pitfalls. A lot of times when I was sitting...
Authorial egos, for example?
Well, yeah, no, that was certainly a big problem. I'd hate to say how poorly some people write... that sent us articles, and then when you'd try to change things, some people were nice about it, but some people weren't. It was a whole different kind of job, a whole different kind of climate, a whole different kind of work relationships. It was interesting. I bonded with the clerks at Yellowstone as well as I bonded with any group of workers, including the teachers I worked with for 32 years, and including the people I worked with in New York. It was just interesting. It was interesting kinds of contrasts.
There are three themes that you lay out in the beginning of the book. One of them is work, which you don't have a very high opinion of, a lot of the work in this country. Another is inequality, and another is destruction of the environment. The inequality piece is something that I find fascinating because it seems that no matter what we do on a sort of moral, spiritual, ethical level, we seem to revert to a kind of medieval serfdom class. I mean, you read Orwell, you read Down and Out in London, Paris, then you look at the way things are in certain parts of Santa Fe or California, and you have the same problem, which is you cannot afford to live on the wages that you make. What's going on?
Well, I think there are a lot of things going on. Well, first of all, I mean, that's not quite true to the extent it is in the United States and a lot of other countries. We have, of all the advanced, you know, rich industrialized nations in the world, we have probably the greatest degree of inequality, the greatest gap between the rich and the poor. Our CEOs make a lot more money than Japanese CEOs or French CEOs make, and our poor people are relatively worse off than poor people in other countries because, at least in those countries, through organization of working people, certain minimum needs are taken care of. Healthcare needs, for example, are taken care of in most of the advanced industrial nations of the world, and they're not taken care of in the United States. So the United States is somewhat unique in that respect. And what's going on, I think, of course, is that working people in the United States, the masses of people, are most poorly organized in the United States than they are anywhere else in the industrial world. And that probably accounts for a lot of it. Because that means that the government's not going to be as responsive. I was watching Michael Moore's fine movie, Sicko, the other day when we were in Boulder, Colorado, and he made one interesting point. He said that in France, the government was afraid of the people. The government was afraid to change something that would adversely affect working people because the working people would take to the streets and protest.
Whereas so you have what you call democracy.
Right, exactly. Let me get to that point in one second. In the United States, he said, on the other hand, people are afraid of the government rather than the other way around. And one of the things that happens when you have this great gap between the rich and the poor, when you have people in Chinatown in Manhattan working 100 hours a week for $2 an hour, against the law, of course, but done nonetheless, and somebody running a hedge fund making $1.7 billion a year, it's hard to have a functioning democracy in the sense that you have majority rule. Because obviously money is extremely important in politics, and when you have that kind of a gap, power gravitates towards the top as well as the money, and so it's hard to have a functioning democracy when you have such great inequality. It really and truly is. If you had a more equal society, I think you would have a more democratic society, and things would be better all around. On average. So that's a really good point. The tremendous increase in inequality that we've experienced over the last, say, 35 years in the United States has probably meant a dwindling in the strength and the power of our democracy.
So basically, things like progressive taxation, living wages, and so on, actually have a directly positive effect on democratic institutions.
No, I think they do. Not only do they raise the living standards of people that need to have their living standards raised so that they can have more of what's necessary to have a good life, but they also they also give anything that secures working people gives them more confidence, and the more confidence people have, the more likely they are to participate in the day-to-day activities of society. When they're poor and demoralized and sick and working themselves to death, then they're not going to be active participants in a democracy, and that's not a healthy thing. And I think that's something that people ought to understand in the United States, that this inequality is bad for democracy. It's also bad for health too, because we're learning that if you have two societies with the same average income, the one in which the incomes are more unevenly divided will have poor health. There'll be more hypertension, there'll be more heart attacks, there'll be more people in prison, there'll be poor schooling results, and so on. So if we had a little bit greater equality in the United States, it would be a social benefit.
We're talking to Michael Yates. The third theme of the book is destruction of the natural world. And this is something that you really observe when you're on a road trip, perhaps more than when you're living in one place all the time.
No, go ahead.
Well, what did it look like? What were some of the common things you saw? What were some of the worst things you saw?
Well, one of the two, I talk about environmental destruction from two perspectives. First of all, and this is interesting in Santa Fe, since this is like the second biggest art capital in the United States, I think, after Manhattan, and that is that in terms of how things are situated spatially in the United States, there seems to be a real lack of a sense of beauty for organizing and developing towns and cities in a way that are eye-pleasing and healthy to live in and not so wasteful of energy.
Do you think eye-pleasing and healthy to live in are related?
Yes, I certainly do. I think that when places are beautiful, people are happier. When places are ugly, people are not so happy, and they're going to be less respectful of the environment. If you have a beautiful place, you hate to desecrate it. I mean, just when you look at it, you say, wow, I don't want to mess that up. Places that are dirty, on the other hand, well, why not throw more trash in? It doesn't really matter. You especially see this in the great desert cities, because deserts are, you know, big open spaces, and the tendency has been for them to sprawl in an unorganized and energy wasteful way, like Phoenix, Tucson, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Las Vegas. No sense of designing those places in an eye-pleasing and energy-efficient way. And so in Albuquerque, you have like this sprawl. You have the city, you have the suburbs, now you have the exurbs.
Rio Rancho.
And they just go on and on and on. The places don't look very nice. They're not very appealing. I've never seen a town like Albuquerque that has so many exits off the highway. There's 19 exits off on 40 alone. And if you count the ones on the north-south road on 25, probably a lot more.
What cities have done it differently and better?
Portland comes to mind as a pretty good example, where Portland has tried to develop their downtown more vertically instead of letting it sprawl out. There's a green zone around Portland so that you can hike actually inside the city limits on miles and miles of hiking trails. They have heritage trees. We could see a redwood from our apartment building. There's free transportation in a ring in the downtown. On electric rails, and so that makes for less pollution. And the center of the city is more dense. People live there, which is always a good sign. When people live in the downtown of a city, you know you got a healthy city. When they don't, you know that you don't. So you don't see like endless strip malls leading into Portland, like you do in so many places. You don't see that immediate sprawl of suburbs and exurbs outside of Portland. So Portland is a city that's probably on the right track. You also don't Although the interstates do divide the city, they probably do so in a less distracting and disruptive way than in, say, Pittsburgh, where we lived before, where interstates just broke in half entire neighborhoods. So I thought Portland was probably on the right track. We saw some small towns like Corvallis, Oregon, which still has an integral good downtown where people actually walk and live and shop. In Missoula, Montana, the big box stores are outside of the town. Don't disrupt the downtown, which is still pretty nice. So there are some places in the United States that have done the right thing. They haven't managed to mess up Manhattan with highways yet too much. So in some ways, Manhattan.
There's no place to sprawl in Manhattan.
No, there's certainly no place to sprawl. It's an island, so that's probably a good sign. Everything's dense and people live there. The big problem in Manhattan, of course, is the disparity between rich and poor. I mean, who can afford to live in Manhattan? You know, the average person can't afford to live there anymore. So the inequalities there are sort of grotesque.
You talked about Portland, and Portland's done a lot of things right. But you also talked about the dark side, which is there's a real sense of racism there.
Yes, certainly. Well, the whole state of Oregon has a sort of pretty bad racial history. It was set up as a white state initially, and there were a lot of roadblocks put in the way of black people, and there aren't very many black people in Oregon. In Portland, for example, black people came in the Second World War to work in the shipyards. They had them living on a floodplain, which soon flooded, and then they moved them out into various urban ghettos, which have since been disrupted by highway development. So now there are little pockets of blacks in Portland, and it seemed like people were a little bit pretty hostile to blacks. There were certain racial incidents with the police that we noticed when we were there, and the way the media responded to it and the talk shows responded to it was pretty ugly. One of the big talk show hosts there, a right-wing talk show host, he was trying to come up with a new slogan for the state of Oregon, and he really liked Habla Español. You know, sort of mocking the idea that there were so many Hispanics coming into Oregon that pretty soon everybody was going to be speaking Spanish. It must sound funny to people here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, where we do speak Spanish.
And in the Southwest, of course, that sounds especially ridiculous. We even learned that in Arizona, another Mexican border state, where it seemed like the most anti-immigrant sentiments were from people who had moved to Arizona from the outside as opposed to people that had lived there for a long time and were used to a bilingual culture. But Oregon, my goodness, you'd have thought that that Mexicans were going to ride in the streets and take over the city at any minute, when in fact they were quite invisible.
And in fact, they were, as you said before, probably the foundation that held up the economic base of the city.
Well, sure. We had our twin sons with us, and one of them worked in a restaurant. And almost every person working in the kitchen, besides the top chefs or the sous chefs, would be Hispanic. They would be Mexican or Salvadoran or from some Latin country. And the same thing was true if you looked in the nice houses in Portland up on the hills. Always the yard work was being done by brown-skinned people. So, yes, you're right. A lot of the core labor, a lot of construction labor, for example, when you'd see new houses being put up, invariably the labor would be brown-skinned. So people in Portland didn't mind brown-skinned people doing that hard labor, but they had this sort of sense of racial superiority at the same time, which I found distressing in a city that had such a liberal reputation.
Heinous is another word that comes to mind. We're talking to Michael Yates. Another question that arose for me is just a personal question. Here you are traveling with your wife. The two of you had raised children, four children together, lived. Suddenly you were one-on-one full-time in a way that you probably hadn't been during the earlier part of your life. What was that like?
Well, we lived in a 10-by-10 room at Yellowstone. The sink was so close to the bed you could sit in the bed and brush your teeth at the same time. And we said, well, if we didn't get divorced then, we probably never would. So it's true. It's true. We are together a lot, and we're in the car together a lot, and we're in closed spaces like in motels a lot. So it does create certain tensions. On the other hand, it allows you to get to know each other in a way that maybe a lot of couples don't get a chance to know when they lead separate lives or have separate jobs and don't see each other. I've known couples that have distance relationships, don't get to see each other very often. One person does a job in one place, one person does a job in another. And so we're not like that. So it was sort of make or break, you know, and we made it, I think, and we get along really well. We discuss things in a way that probably a lot of couples don't discuss things. We bounce ideas off each other. Karen was the editor of this book. We spent 10-hour tense days in Estes Park, Colorado when I wrote the book, going over it line by line. We had a lot of arguments, but in the end it turned out to be a much better book and our relationship got closer. So I'm not going to say that there aren't tensions and you don't like to get away from one another every now and then, but on the other hand, it's helped to deepen our relationship too.
So where are you now in the process? I was thinking at the beginning of the book where you talk about this sense of not really ever having felt like you belonged anywhere. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. Now you've lived in cheap motels and a hot plate and in your van and Yellowstone and Miami Beach and New York and all sorts of, you know, the West Coast. Where are you now?
Well, we're in the middle of a 90-day book tour, which takes us
travelogue.
Yeah, it takes us all across the country. I've got a website, www.cheapmotelsandahotplate.org, and I have a blog there where I'm keeping a record of our travel, sort of like a travelogue inside of this book tour if anybody's interested in checking that out. I can't make real deep observations because I have to write pretty quickly, but interesting ones, I think nonetheless. We're going to end up in Amherst, Massachusetts, where I got a job as a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts for the fall term, and that'll take us through January 20th. And after that, I don't know what we're going to do. We have to regroup in Massachusetts and try to figure out where we're going to go.
Are you drawn to the open road, or do you feel like staying put?
Well, we're drawn to the open road, but we've crisscrossed the United States so many times, I think probably it's going to be time to, if we could swing it, to live outside of the country and experience other societies. You know, a couple people have told me that we should really spend time in Canada, for example, and compare what I've seen in the book to what we would see in Canada. Europe, Latin America, Australia, New Zealand, these are all possibilities. If we could swing it financially, that would probably be the main concern. But I probably would like to do that. I've seen a lot of the United States, 100-some thousand miles, all different kinds of towns and cities. I point out in the last part of the book that I still don't think I'm on intimate terms with the country, but I know a little bit about it, and now maybe it's time to expand and learn something about other countries before I get too old to do that.
Michael Yates, thank you so much for being with us on KSFR.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Yates is the author of the book Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist's Travelogue, and he will be at Garcia Street Books today at 5 o'clock reading from his book and signing books. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the photography of Lewis Hines. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Julia Dolan. She is a research scholar at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and she will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock in a lecture called Industrial Fireworks, Lewis Hines Empire State Building Photographs in the Popular Press at the O'Keeffe Museum Annex on Grant Avenue. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Lewis Hine, very interesting photographer. Who was he?
Well, Lewis Hine lived from 1874 until 1940, and he was born in Wisconsin and moved to New York to teach originally at the Ethical Culture School in Manhattan. And in about 1904, he began learning photography so that he could produce images of school and school activities. And from there, he moved his way into the progressive reform movement and produced photographs such as, most people tend to know his Ellis Island work that he produced, actually in three different phases, but most people know his early sort of 1905 to 1909 work from Ellis Island.
Where he photographed immigrants coming in from Europe.
Yep. First days in the United States coming straight off the ships and being processed into the United States.
How did he choose that? Was he commissioned to do that work? Did he just choose to do it?
It's something, as far as I'm aware, he chose to do on his own. Part of the Ethical Culture School's methodology was to actually bring the students out into the community, to have them learn from individuals within the community of Manhattan itself, and to sort of understand that people, whether they were poor or wealthy, that everyone has something to contribute to society. And so one of their main goals was to get, again, children out into the community, and going to Ellis Island was a way for students to understand that just like the pilgrims from the 17th century, new immigrants were incredibly important to the to the growth of the United States. So that's one of the reasons that he did decide to go there. But originally it was for field trips for the students themselves to learn photography. He gave the students cameras and they were shown how to photograph people and the area and the environment at Ellis Island, but it became a rather large project for him as well.
And then he moved on to photographs that had a real overt political advocacy angle to them.
Absolutely. In 1908, he actually left the Ethical Culture School because he was becoming so busy with his photographic work and was hired full-time by the National Child Labor Committee, which was charged with trying to make the lives of child workers better. It wasn't necessarily a means to end child labor completely. It was trying to get children out of factories and get them back into the schools, to not have them work 10 to 12 hour days, and to enforce some of the state laws that were actually already on the books since the late 19th century, which were not being enforced either by the parents or by the mill or factory owners at the time.
And so he went into mills and factories and said, I'm going to photograph your pathetically exploited children.
Well, actually, no. He most certainly didn't say it that way. He would often lie his way into the situations because the mill owners did not want the fact that 6 and 7 and 8 year old children were being exposed to high noise levels and incredibly dangerous looms and so on. So he would say that he was a Bible seller or a postcard seller or just wanting to talk to the children about religion or things like that. And he would often hide his camera and camera equipment underneath his coat. And
still made incredible photographs.
He did, absolutely. If you take a look at them, they're incredibly well composed. And he made thousands of them over the course of 10 years. So of course there are many of them that are not particularly fantastic. But some of them are absolutely gorgeous as artistic objects, even though they had an incredible sort of social component to them.
Did he ever get busted by mill owners?
Oh, yes, he did. And he was threatened with his life a number of times and had to run out of a number of mills and so on. And there are certain mills where he just never was able to get into. So he would photograph the children outside of the mills or he would photograph the children at their homes.
So where did these photographs go and what political effect did they have?
They were placed in a number of magazines, political reform magazines, social reform magazines, such as The Survey or Everybody's Magazine. He also developed a number of different formats, pamphlets and booklets that would be handed out to people at talks and at lectures, lantern slide lectures and so on. He would do things like that with them. So he tried to get them out to the public as much as possible and into the popular press. Not so much the mainstream popular press. They weren't as ready to accept such images, but a more sort of niche market press for the social reform movement.
But they did then have the political effect of reform.
To an extent, absolutely. They did draw the attention of a number of reformers, a number of legislators as well. And in that period, sort of the pre-World War I period, there was a large push for federal child labor reform because most child labor laws on the books at the time were state level, and they just weren't well enforced. So there was a federal push during the time that Hines' photographs were being made, and his photographs were used in order to push those laws through.
Another set of things that he did was he photographed not just children, but adult workers.
Absolutely. And that's something that I am most interested in my work at this point, is the work that Hein produced after World War I. There's a tendency to prefer, in the larger Hein scholarship, his earlier work that is very closely tied to the social reform movement. But after 1919-1920, he started working a little more closely with different capitalist groups and companies and so on. And so a lot of scholars seem to have a problem with that.
He was a sellout.
They do very gently often say that he was a sellout. They don't prefer his aesthetic at that time as much because it did change. It became much more hard-edged. To me, in many ways, it's more visually beautiful in certain aspects. He certainly was paying attention to the avant-garde movement that was going on in Europe and that was trickling its way into the United States. And he's very interested in the machine itself. But what's great about Hein, when we look at incredibly beautiful photographs by someone like Charles Sheeler or Margaret Bourke White, we don't see the individual in those images. If the individual is in there, it's often to show scale. We see the machine
themselves.
You see
the beauty of the machine.
The gorgeous, right, high-tech machine. But Hein is emphatic about including individuals, the actual worker, in those images, and to basically show that, with yes, machinery is propelling us into a new age at this time, but without the human factor, there's no way that these machines would work. And
And you look at these pictures and you wonder, I don't know, I find myself wondering whether there's a sort of weird tension between the beauty of the photographs and the very harsh realities that these people are working in.
There is, definitely, and I think that might be, to an extent, some of the problems that some scholars have with Heim's work, is that he's, in effect, airbrushing away some of these issues that were brought up in the 1920s because of technology and the way that it was reducing the skilled labor force. And people were working at assembly lines and doing one thing repeatedly over and over, and it didn't take an incredible amount of skill. Because they are aesthetically very beautiful to look at, but they do tend to gloss over sometimes those deeper social issues about industry and technology.
Well, he was a reformer very much. And
yes.
So this later body of work where he was hired by corporations themselves, what was the purpose of the work and how was it used?
Well, it depends on the situation. He worked for Western Electric for quite a long time, maybe 4 years or so during the 1920s. And the photographs that were used by Western Electric were placed in their employee magazine. So his images of employees were being reached, were being sent out to employees themselves. And again, they're mainly imagery of individuals working with machinery. And it was a way, I think, a sort of public relations move in order to sell the corporation to the employees themselves, because this is at a time when people are still striking rather often and having problems with the larger corporate culture. So his imagery, in a sense, tried to smooth over that corporation-employee relationship.
Was he okay with that?
He
was a socialist.
He was, but So he's sort of a gentle socialist. He wasn't radical. And some of his imagery might seem radical in the earlier stages, but to a certain extent, I think he believed in capitalism and the way that it propelled the United States into this world power, particularly after World War I. But he was absolutely committed to making sure that the American worker had an important place within that nexus of capitalism. And I think through his imagery, he did want to show to these corporate entities that they could not exist without the human factor in industry. So it's a push and pull for him, certainly. And at times he may have been conflicted, but he truly believed that his job was to show the positive aspects of industry and labor.
We're talking to Julia Dolan, research scholar at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, about the work of photographer Louis Heim. Now, let's talk about a little bit about the, give people a taste of what they're going to hear tonight if they go at 7 o'clock. It's called Louis Heim's Empire State Building Photographs in the Popular Press, 1930-31. So we've had the great crash.
The
Depression is now starting to deepen.
To take hold, absolutely. And this manifestation of a lifetime of looking at labor, I think, it really is represented well in his Empire State Building photographs. Between 1930 and 1931, for about 6 months, mostly in 1930, Heim climbed floor by floor with the laborers and produced 1,000 images.
Now, floor by floor of a building under construction.
Yeah, not safe.
A skeleton of a, not
absolutely
scary as heck.
Scary as heck, which he writes about in 1931 and 1932, that there were times that he almost fell. He was absolutely nervous, but the workers helped him through it, and it seems like they enjoyed having him there. But yes, floor by floor, he went up to the 102nd floor to the tip of the mooring mast with these workers, and primarily the steel workers, as the steel skeleton was being constructed, and photographed them, photographed their work. There are images of the building itself, but it is truly about the worker. He is most interested in how these men, and it was only men, put this building together. And he shows that even though this is an incredible monument to technology and industry, without these men, there is no way that this building could exist.
It's interesting. This is a theme that came up in the program earlier today. Also, the human underpinnings of everything that is worthwhile in our society.
Absolutely.
Everything that we use and see and do. Who hired him to make these photographs?
That's a great question, and it's still a little bit murky. Some people say that one of the architects, Shreve Lamon Harmon, was the architectural firm. Shreve actually lived in the same neighborhood that Heim did. I tend to think that it was perhaps Belle Moskowitz who hired him, and she is the or was the head of Publicity Associates, which was the public relations firm hired to take care of the Empire State Building account. And she was a social reformer back in the early 20th century, and she worked at the Survey magazine at the same time that Haim did. So even though I have no sort of one-to-one correlation between them knowing each other 30 years prior, or 20 years prior, I'm quite certain that she had a lot to do with the hiring of Lewis Hine for this particular project.
And the purpose was to, I mean, of these photographs, was to be used in the popular press?
Absolutely. And that's something that a lot of people don't necessarily realize, and what is so fascinating to me, because if we know Empire State Building imagery, we typically know a number of Lewis Hine's images, but we only see them on a gallery wall. We don't see what they were like in their original context. And he did not specifically make them to be artistic objects. They were used in newspapers on a very regular basis in 1930 and 1931 and were reprinted hundreds of times throughout the country.
It brings up an interesting relationship between the PR industry and the press. I mean, the popular press, in theory, has their own photographers and their own editorial.
Sure. And something to think about, though, at this particular time as well, are the wire services. And what Publicity Associates did was basically use his photographs and send them out to wire services to give a very specific type of message to newspaper and magazine readers about this particular building. Especially during a time of great economic crisis, why does one need another monument to capitalism? So what these photographs really do
question.
Is... Yeah, and what these photographs do is show that it's putting workers to work. It's... even though it is this monument to capitalism and we're questioning what capitalism really means to us during this Great Depression, it shows the heroism of it and the grandeur and how American industry and American capitalism can rise above. They're celebratory images, absolutely, and it's a great way to sort of call people to the structure.
Where did they end up being printed? What kind of magazines or newspapers?
All sorts, anything from the New York Times. The New York City Press was... enamored of them, certainly. They were printed in California. They were printed in the Midwest. They were printed in London. I've seen them in German press as well, in the Saturday Evening Post. So quite a range. And then they were also printed in certain social reform magazines that had still survived past the main social reform time period of the pre-war.
And something that you point out about these photographs is it puts the viewer of the photograph in the position of the worker so that they feel like they're somehow on or in the growing being built Empire State Building.
Absolutely, and that's something I think that was really important to the public relations firm to show people that they too could actually stand where these workers once stood, because there are two, not one, but there are actually two viewing platforms in the Empire State Building, one on the 86th floor and one on the 102nd floor. And the editorials made it very clear that this was a place that anyone could come and visit and then stand where these workers stood and get this sort of magisterial view of Manhattan as they did, but safely, of course.
Julia Dolan, we are out of time. If people are interested in hearing more about this, they can go to the O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. And reservations are suggested, although not necessary. 946-1039 is the telephone number over there. Julia Dolan is a research scholar at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the radio at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my website where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are moving up the dial, ladies and gentlemen, to 101.1 FM for the next few months. We're simulcasting, and eventually 101.1 FM will be our only home. So readjust your car radio and your home radio to 101.1 FM, Santa Fe Public Radio. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Joe Lovano. The first hour of Giants of Jazz features trombonist Kai Winding, and J.J. Johnson. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.